Hello. This is Helen, Her Stories Handwritten, Part 2.
She was writing something just about every day. I didn't know this.
No.
That Mom did this. I can find letters. I can find this kind of daily notes. And then I can find something like a more personal journal. Like she was writing on all these different levels too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Helen's son, Dave Dirksen, and that was my sister, Lynn, who joins me on this episode to share some stories about Mum growing up. A few pieces of writing have survived from this time, but on this episode, we will supplement those writings with our recollections of the stories she told us, newspaper clippings, and descriptions of photos she kept. Also helping with part two are Lynn's daughter Madeline, our brother Bob and sister Barb, and our cousin Judith, as well as my wife Marlis. Thanks for listening. Here's part two. In part one, we heard about Helen's early childhood, how their family came to Canada, the loving home that she grew up in, going to German school on Saturdays, and how their lives revolved around the Mennonite church at which her father was the pastor. Photos of her as a preteen, teen, and young adult show her having fun with friends at school and in the community beyond the Mennonite church. They also show her interest in fashion and hairstyles. She definitely integrated into mainstream society. One of the ways that Helen integrated was through good friendships. Here's my sister Barb, who helped me to recall some of those special friendships. I found it really interesting that she talks about how centered on the church and their church community her life is, but yet she's got all of these friends who are not church friends. Like, she just loved school and she loved her school friends. And so Mary Cohn, Mary Davidson, mm-hmm. who ended up being her maid of honor or whatever at her wedding, she was one of those friends that she met in elementary school, and they stayed friends, well, their whole lives.
Grade 7.
These other kids that she was really close to, so, and they called themselves
Dilly, Daisy, and Dolly. Now, I think, I'm guessing, but I think Dolly was Mary Davidson, Daisy was Pat Goff, and Dilly was Mom, I think.
Yeah.
But I can't be sure.
And they had all kinds of fun together. Like, she talked about tap dancing with these girls and tap dancing for her dad, the Mennonite pastor, who is supposed to maybe be a, take a hard line on dancing.
Oh, my goodness.
And she said that he just enjoyed it so much. He would just laugh. You know, her mom would, you know, sort of maybe be in the background saying, well, we should be saying tisk tisk to this. But he would just laugh and you know, he was delighted by their energy and just the spirit of fun.
Of course. You know. Of course.
So, but they did all kinds of shenanigans. And she would talk about how they walked from 3rd Avenue to City Park Collegiate when they were in high school, which is better part of a mile. And they would go there in the morning, walk home together at lunch, walk back in the afternoon, walk back after school. So they spent like 4 miles of walking together every day, picking up one another at different the houses along the way and just having a great time.
Like, that's just so happy.
Yeah. Oh, they were.
Despite growing up in a German-speaking home, Helen learned to read and write in English, and those became the passions of her life. She held a Saskatoon Public Library card for almost 90 years. And as a young person, she spent a lot of time at the library, even working as a page at one point. In fact, she was such a fixture there that longtime librarians Muriel Clancy and Frances Morrison, famous librarians in Saskatoon, encouraged her to become a librarian. Here's my brother Bob to shed a bit of light on this part of Mum's life.
She was a page. What is a page?
It could have changed over time, but the role of the page, even recently, was to be a kind of dog's body. She could have been retrieving books, shelving books, doing any number of different humdrum tasks. you look at pictures, and she has that that concentrated expression, that that there's a charisma there, and something striking about her look, her poise, whatever. People notice that. Muriel Clancy, Frances Morrison, probably the same thing. Who's that girl? She has the right manner, the right quality of attention. She's doing humdrum things as a page, but isn't doing them in a humdrum way. Maybe. I think that's probably most of what's going on.
Helen seriously considered becoming a librarian, largely out of respect for Clancy and Morrison, but there was no money to go to the training course in the Maritimes. Plus, she divulged to me that she was a terrible student, really didn't like studying. She just wanted to read and write what interested her. So she passed on librarian school and attending university. Instead, after high school, she enrolled in a business course. She said she was pretty good at accounting, but terrible at shorthand. So she ended up dropping out halfway through when a high school friend put in a good word for her and got her a job at the bank. In 1949, Helen and some other friends planned a trip together, and that adventure became a favorite memory of Helen's to recount. And those friends were a constant for the rest of her life in a group they called Club. Here's Lynn with more on this.
I found stuff about Club. So here's what she wrote in these notes. So she wrote, somehow all our holidays were arranged for the same time. We weren't quite sure how this came about, but happily accepted. We would pay expenses.
21 years old. I think she's working at the bank at the time. Hey, that's how she...
Probably, yeah.
That's how she ended up with some cash. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think Mom always liked looking at coincidences and serendipity, that kind of thing. So I think she liked this, that their holidays somehow happened at all the same time. So it was easy for them to go on this trip. So then to Muir, M-U-R.
Murray.
Yeah.
And then Murray, just so helplessly in love with one of them, or maybe many of them, he drove out so that then he could chauffeur them around to their various places out
what?
There. Yeah. And then there are pictures of Murray, you know, sitting with one or more of them, sort of like he's obviously just completely smitten. I'll drive all the way out there to Banff and just be your chauffeur. Sure.
Oh, my gosh.
There are pictures of Murray driving them all out there. So I think he didn't have to drive out by himself. And a great photo of these, you know, saucy, naughty girls and Murray at Drumheller. And so there's the Drumheller sign, home of the dinosaurs. So, yes. You know, they're obviously fully youthful. And so they're not dinosaurs. But then there's another one where they all have their hands up covering letters except hell. And
I
then
probably laughed so hard.
Yeah. And then there are pictures of them on tandem bikes, not just single bikes. They're petting deer in another picture. Mum is not. She's standing back from that. There's a picture of Murray sitting up really close and with his arm around Mum. So,
oh, really?
Apparently. Oh, so Murray. I'm not sure exactly who he was there to. I mean, the story was always that he was sweet on Betty. So, but anyway.
Yeah, okay. And then she says bikes and bought matching hats. Must be bungalows.
And so she has a brochure from Becker's Bungalows.
Becker's. And
she has in a shaky hand, she's got number 6. She remembered like way later. In number 6.
Singing, she writes that. Oh, yeah. Murr to Lake Louise and Johnson's Canyon.
For sure. Hey, Murray, go get the car.
want to know what happened to Murray. Horseback riding, Dolly, Horseshoe Canyon. And yeah, she said they had a guide.
Right. So they would have set off and then gone out along the Bow River to Horseshoe Canyon on horseback. Yeah. It would have been lovely. Okay. And then it says horseback riding, Ginger, Dolly, Breezy, Smokey, and Claybank. So Dolly was a horse.
They went to a production of Oedipus Rex. Right. Is that right?
Yeah, at the Banff School of Fine Arts. So they got all dressed up and they were having like just a time. They were the first mountain bikers of the family. And then this horseback riding and sightseeing, but then dressing up and going out to the theater. The Banff School of Fine Arts Drama Division presents Sophocles, King Oedipus, and Happy Journey. August 18 and 19, 1949, in the Banff School Auditorium.
Dinner at BSH?
Banff Springs Hotel.
Of course, yeah.
So they go, they were living large.
They were. On Sunday, they went to church.
Yeah, there's a photo of them all dressed in skirts and heels to go to church.
Okay, and then she said, we formed a firm, strong bond,
friendship.
I guess. Yeah, so that's that one.
That is
so cool to have. And this is what she remembered. It can't have been that long ago from now, like maybe in the last 5 years, because the handwriting.
Right. So she was She was just going back through the pleasant memories. And this is from the little notes that I have. This is one of the things that she was really doing a lot of, which is living in positive memories to draw forth gratitude and to stay on the positive side of the ledger of how she was feeling psychologically.
Yeah, that's right. I have gratitude journal that she wrote.
So the last thing from this little scrapbook of the old days anyway is that there are a whole bunch of pictures from Clear Lake in 19.
Yeah.
So they went again July 50th.
That's right.
30th, 1950, she has labeled here. They stayed in Idlewild bungalows and she was in number 19. The things she documents. Great. All kinds of pictures of them kind of sitting like four of them on a blanket and four of them in one little gazebo. Like they were very, very close.
At the same time in the early 1950s, among her many close friendships, Helen was getting to know a young farm boy named Merv. I'm sure she wrote about their early romance, but she didn't let that journal fall into the hands of her children. So while we will read many things that Helen wrote about Merv during their 50 years of marriage, for their early years, we'll have to let pictures and a newspaper reporter tell the story. Hey, so do you want to introduce yourself?
My name is Marla Sturkson. I'm your wife.
Do you want to introduce yourself in relationship to Helen?
I was Helen's favorite daughter-in-law.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
I knew you wanted me to say that. It was a running joke.
She would say that.
Yeah.
Favorite and only. That's good.
Only, that's how I got that title.
Yeah.
But we were very fond of each other.
Yeah, and so regarding their dating or courtship, we don't really have a lot. You've got some pictures there, though. What are you seeing in those pictures?
Well, I'm seeing a young, beautiful Merv and Helen, prime of their lives.
How would you describe Merv in those pictures? These are from her photo album, so they're pictures she was fond of.
Yes. Well, I've heard your dad described as having movie star good looks in his youth, and I thought it would certainly be true. And anyway, very handsome, beautiful smile, dapper.
Kind of a dashing farm boy, though, hey? Like he's on a tractor.
That one's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But But the rest, he's looking pretty sharp.
Yeah. And then there's a series of pictures at the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So what's she wearing to the farm?
Well, she's got a very pretty dress on. Printed pattern dress and high heels. And she kind of looks like a city girl at the farm.
Exactly.
Looks like she was dressing to impress, maybe, or
yeah.
Or maybe that's just how she dressed at the time. Like, got her hair's done, she's got nicely curled, styled hair, and
just seems a little incongruous with the farm somehow, you know?
Well, I think she was incongruous with the farm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When all was said and done, I think she was a city girl.
Yeah. But so, yeah, they seem, there's that lovely picture of her throwing her arms around him.
Yeah.
Out at the farm. So, yeah. Anyway, that's basically, I mean, that is it in terms of what we have from her in her scrapbook about their dating time. So, anything about their wedding?
Mr. and Mrs. J.J. Teeson request the honor of your presence at the marriage of their daughter, Helen Margaret, to Mervyn Kenneth Dirksen on Saturday, February the 3rd, 1951, at 7 o'clock, First Mennonite Church, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Reception at the church.
And then, I don't know who reported on weddings back then, but this is a pretty interesting piece from the Star Phoenix.
Yeah, we were quite amazed at the detail and the... Yeah, who would do it? Did you have a reporter on the spot, or would you submit information after? I'd be curious to know.
So, yeah, that'll be interesting. Go ahead.
The bride's father officiated at the evening marriage ceremony in the First Mennonite Church when Helen Margaret Teeson, daughter of the Reverend J.J. Teeson and Mrs. Teeson of this city, became the bride of Miss Mervyn Kenneth Dirksen, son of Mr. and Mrs. William Dirksen of Langham. Palms, ferns, baskets of spring flowers, and lighted tapers in candelabra made a pretty setting for the service, and the bride, who was given in marriage by her brother-in-law, Mr. V. J. Lowen, was attractively dressed in heavy white satin, on train, with tiny lace-trimmed collar. Her net veil was edged with a wide band of lace, and she carried a shower bouquet of red roses and white carnations. Attendants were her sister, Miss Catherine Teeson, and Miss Mary Davidson, wearing gowns of pale blue velvet with matching braided coronets in their hair. They carried colonial bouquets of pink carnations centered with a single white rose. Mr. Walter Teeson played the bridal music, and the choir was in attendance. A reception followed in the church parlors for about 200 guests. A white linen cloth covered the bride's table, on which the three-tiered wedding cake, embedded in blue teal, held the place of honor, and it was lighted by blue and white candles. For the wedding trip to Edmonton, the bride changed to a rose gabardine suit with black accessories, complemented by a corsage of pink and white carnations. Upon their return, Mr. and Mrs. Dirksen will make their home in Saskatoon.
Yeah, that's a lot of detail. I got to think that she must have written that and sent it to...
Submitted it.
And that must have been the way it went, that you would write it and then submit it. Yeah, it does sound like something she would have written, though.
Or maybe they had a form and you sort of...
Right.
And they embellished her.
Right. Well, that was the big day.
Pretty evocative.
Yeah, for sure. So that's what we know.
One interesting story that Mum told me about the time early in their marriage was that she wanted to contribute to the family income by keeping her job. However, the practice at the bank was that once a woman was married, she would resign and focus on being a wife and tending her home. Helen was determined.
She made a formal written appeal to the bank requesting permission to continue working as a married woman. Her application was successful, and she held on to her position at the bank. However, a year later, when she was expecting her first child, she was dismissed without opportunity for appeal. No pregnant woman was allowed to work at the bank in the early 1950s.
There's only one other piece in her scrapbook that kind of bridges both the club and the courtship and marriage to Dad. That is a speech that her club friend Betty gave at their 40th anniversary. You want to read some of that?
Sure. So she writes, Helen and Merv, what a wonderful day. What a wonderful milestone. It hardly seems possible that 40 years ago, a handsome young couple was standing in church exchanging their wedding vows. Your gentle and kind father, Helen, was ministering to you with a little homily explaining that marriage was not always a smooth ride, that sometimes the road was bumpy and difficult. In your mind, Helen, you were saying, but Father, we are in love. Nothing will be bumpy and difficult. Your father was a very wise man. All marriages have good times and also some not so good times. You have accepted these good times and not so good times with grace, dignity, and charm. You have been a very special lady. Elsie Gertsen, Helen, and I have belonged to a club for over 40 years. Originally, there were 5 members in the club, but 2 moved away shortly after our beginning, and so our husbands dubbed our gathering as the Chesterfield Club, as we were the only club in town that could sit on one Chesterfield. In today's jargon, we would be called a support group, but all we knew then was that we looked forward to seeing one another every second week. We were friends, and that meant that any of our discussions were for our ears only, and so it was excellent therapy for 3 young mothers. We discussed our common problems, such as, would the colic ever end? Would we ever get a night's sleep through? And as our families grew, did anyone have any snappy new ideas how to stretch a pound of hamburger meat even further? The answer was usually throw in some more oatmeal. We were fiber conscious long before it was the popular thing to do. Mostly our concerns were common ones to all 3. But occasionally we would have a problem specific to ourselves. One night, we met at night first, as our husbands would babysit for us. We noticed that Helen was a bit perplexed. We asked her what the problem was, and she replied that Merv wanted to buy a brood sow. This was a problem beyond the experience of Elsie and I, and you had to wrestle with it yourself. We don't know to this day if he bought the sow or not. Did he? As you can well imagine, in our early years, there seemed to be one of us pregnant at any one time. Guess what? No, not again. Yep. We were very fortunate with only the usual little minor concerns. When Helen was pregnant with David, she inadvertently twisted her ankle and was in a great deal of pain. Her ankle had swollen so badly that she could not get her shoe on and had to make do with an old slipper. She received very little sympathy, however, from her doctor, as on one of her visits, when she shuffled in, he burst into laughter. If you were a horse, he said, we would shoot you and put you out of your misery. Helen, as the years went by and our friendship deepened, I was always amazed and astonished at your ever-expanding caring and helping of people. Your love was an ever-renewable resource that kept growing and growing. You were completely devoted to Merv. You took great pride and joy in your wonderful family. You watched over your mother and father. You had great concern for your siblings and their families. You had a quiet devotion to your church and to your community, and you still had time to care about your many, many friends. You never once let us down, be it cleaning a house for a friend from top to bottom when she had lost her father, or more recently sharing the largesse of your bountiful kitchen with your friend who had broken her leg, knowing from firsthand experience how immobile one is with a big, fat cast. You were always there. I think your dear granddaughter, Ileana, summed it up for all of us very well. She was watching CFQC TV one day and they were asking for nominations for Citizen of the Year. Her query was, what was a Citizen of the Year? The reply was someone in the community who is caring and loving and is always doing nice things for people. Without skipping a beat, she replied, that's my Grandma Helen. Thank you, Helen and Murr, for being such an exemplary couple. And thank you for being our friends. We all love you very much.
Isn't that nice? Only a dear friend, hey, could write all that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Long and rich friendship, right to the end.
So does anything else stand out to you from that piece or from the wedding piece or from their courtship pictures?
I've always admired the depth and breadth of your mom's friendships. Having friends as long as she did and friendships that she nurtured and maintained was amazing to me. Yeah, she really did stay connected and enrich the lives of a lot of people.
Yeah, and we didn't even mention yet her maid of honor, who was Mary Davidson, Mary Cone,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who was a lifelong friend. They were connected right to the into their 90s. She definitely did maintain friendships. And there are photos of all of these different people. I don't even know who they are in her old photo albums of all these people she was close to. Yeah, that was definitely part of who she was.
Well, and continued making friends right up until the end, which I marveled at as well. Like,
yeah,
caregivers, EMT attendant, I mean, not friends in the true sense, but they just really took a shine to her in a curry. Like, she just was very warm.
Yeah.
Very interested in people, very kind, very gracious.
Yeah. She was definitely someone people connected with. Yeah, you're right. Right up into the hospital stay where her bedmate, Sylvia, became a really good friend right at the end. So,
yeah. And vowed to watch over her when you guys had to go home at night.
Right.
And yeah, it was remarkable and inspiring, you know.
Okay, thanks for doing that.
You're welcome.
So those club friendships did last a lifetime. Here's Lynn to finish up that part of the story.
So she writes about the anniversary trip that they did in, this was 97, when they went on their trip to Whistler. Notes about what they did. Here. So May 5th, rainy day. Betty and I went out for the paper. Betty found a hat shop and bought us each a hat, all the same. We attracted a lot of attention with our hats. And they would go to breakfast in their dressing gowns.
It's so cool that reunion trip idea came about 50 years later. And from the pictures, it looks like they were back in that youthful spirit. They all have big, broad-brimmed blue hats, and they're all arm-in-arm outside of the condo.
Are they floppy hats?
Yeah.
Oh, they're so cute.
It's
oh
my so gosh. Great.
Yeah.
Just
yes.
Laughing and doing goofy stuff and going for breakfast.
Yeah.
And putting on their matching hats. I don't think they went horseback riding, but I wonder if Murray wanted to come along.
I wonder if anybody thought about him at all.
Just Murray just driving his car from, you know, now lives in Ontario, but he drives all the way to Whistler.
Yeah.
Just to be there.
Yeah, I would do it. I'd do it.
How they got to Whistler, it was not Murray. It was, and she's kept the certificate from the limousine service that took them from the airport to Whistler. So there you go.
I have something about that. Our limousine driver, Ron, arrives. We have to cross the street in the rain. He is not allowed to park above. A jolly man, but he gets frustrated with the drivers on the busy highway. We talk, laugh, and enjoy being together. Elsie begins to feel sick. She is riding backwards, so Betty switches with her. We stop in Squamish for tea and a rest, then on to Whistler.
That's great. Those are little anecdotes.
I know. She also says, Betty and I sleep in the loft, Barbara on the single, Elsie on the fold-out couch. Sweet dreams, only they are not for Betty. I snored, so she moved to the single. Barb in with Elsie. I feel so badly.
And then I have a letter from Elsie. Surprise, happy brick day. Dear Helen, the Miwasan Foundation is using paving bricks to build a promenade along Honest Park between the Delta Bezboro and the Broadway Bridge. People were encouraged to immortalize loved ones' names on the bricks used in the construction. Therefore, there will be a brick with the names Betty, Elsie, Helen, Barb, Glady on one of them that will be placed near the Bezboro. Next time you're around the Bezboro, look for it and enjoy seeing the names of five special friends that go back to the 40s. Love, Elsie. And then she's got a picture of that brick.
Yeah, I've seen it. I think it was hard to find the first time.
Oh, I imagine. It's just, one brick.
Just one brick. So I found a couple of other little entries about her friends. Okay, so this I found really interesting. So this is September 11th. So Tuesday a.m., Betty phoned to say that two passenger planes, terrorists, hijackers, had hit the Trade Center Twin Towers in New York City. What a dreadful happening. Hard to believe that such a thing could happen. There is a great loss of lives in the buildings and the poor people in the planes. What will this mean for all of us? War? That's how George Bush is talking. This is so frightening. So then the next sentence is, had club at Betty's in the afternoon. And then, she says, baked a plot for Viola because her husband had just died. So there's mom going from this horrendous event that nobody could make any sense out of, and then just going back to the things that were familiar and gave her strength, like club and baking a plot for somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was such a newspaper reader and so aware of what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet really lived locally, doing what she could, having friendships, doing good things for her friends and neighbors.
Yeah. I don't know. I really liked that. This is a nice one from June 8th of 1990. Long walk with Merv in the evening. River is very high, sandbars covered. Head club, Elsie's birthday. And then she writes, club today, here. Made a flapper pie in the morning. Lunch at the park town. We had a window table with the view of the bridge and riverbank. Gave gifts. We had a great afternoon.
Along with the special bonds she shared with her club pals and many other friends, Helen was also very close to her two sisters and her brother. As a young married woman in the early 1950s, she was very connected to her eldest sister, Haiti. They both had children. Their husbands, Vic and Merv, got along famously, and they had common interests. The two families spent a lot of time socializing and traveling together, especially to Waskasu Lake in the boreal forest of beautiful Prince Albert National Park, a couple of hours' drive north of Saskatoon. With that as background, we'll share an important chapter in Helen's story.
Okay. I'm Maddie, and I am Helen's granddaughter.
For this section, we're looking at a copy of a Saskatoon Star Phoenix newspaper page that was among Mum's things. The article is from 1954, and Helen has written on it in the margins.
The article includes a picture of Helen's brother-in-law, Flight Officer Victor Lowen, in uniform.
I'll read some of that article and then I'll pass it over to Maddie to read what Mum has written. An eyewitness is quoted in the article saying, "I had just gone out on the front porch after the storm had subsided to look at the size of the hailstones when I heard an airplane flying low. I remember thinking, who would be flying on a night like this, when suddenly a blinding flash of lightning lit up the whole area. My husband, Bud, was looking out the window, and he yelled, 'Look, there's a plane on fire over there!' Then a second later, he shouted, 'It crashed!'"
Under the picture of Flight Officer Victor Lowen, in the article, it says, "Teacher at Bedford Road Collegiate. He leaves a widow and two children, Victor 10 and Judy 4. Mrs. Lowen and the children were on vacation in the Prince Albert National Park."
And now to the part that Mum wrote in response to that newspaper article.
"The crash took place on August 12, 1954. This report would have been in the August 13th Star Phoenix. The children, Haiti and I, were at Emma Lake waiting for Merv and Vic to arrive for a holiday there. They didn't come the next day. The RCMP came to the house and gave us the news. They asked us to sit down. I thought there must have been a car accident with Merv and Vic involved. I was shaking. We were both stunned. Very shortly after that, Dad and Merv arrived. Merv had waited for the arrival of the plane at the RCRF gates at the airport. He realized that something was wrong when there was no plane arrival and the officers on duty showed some concern." In Grandma's writing, she's not saying like this, and that like this was a life-changing event, which would be so easy to write that in a piece of writing like this. Instead of that, she just very clearly explains the sequence of events, the emotions they were feeling, and the like representation that she received from her husband about what it felt like to wait for a plane that didn't arrive.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like there's an absence of herself. When I was thinking about this a lot, it's because of how, I don't know, fascinating like memory and like mismemory are. Because, yeah, it's so easy to misremember things or like memories aren't reliable necessarily. I got really fascinated with Haiti because, yeah, I mean, I've known people who've had really wild things happen to them or life-changing things happen. But this one was just, it's just so dramatic in some way. But my perception of Aunt Haiti or my memories of Aunt Haiti, like, I don't know, you would like never have known in some way that she had been through this trauma, because from my perspective as a child, there is just like this like brightness around her, you know? So it wasn't what, like she didn't lead with it, I guess is what I'm saying. That's also my, like my memory being like tricky maybe or something.
Yeah, no, I perceived it the exact same way. The bond that Mom and Aunt Haiti had was a joyful one. They had so much fun together, and you didn't get a sense of sorrowfulness from her.
I think it's important to say that it's not because like people should get over stuff or like be cheerful when bad things happen. That's not the point, but it's a sort of thing like, how does someone get there? And I wonder if it was this sort of thing, like even with the absence of the person, keeping the relationship there and keeping it positive and like keeping it moving.
But in this little description written in the margins of a newspaper report about a horrendous event, you get a sense of the emotion that went into the event for
mom and for Aunt Haiti, the waiting. Like, we don't wait anymore. We've got, like, someone would have texted her. They waited all night. He didn't arrive.
Yeah.
And then the RCMP show up, and you know that something's up, and they're shaking, and you don't really need to write the aftermath, you know, overwhelming emotion that gripped them, you can imagine. But yeah, you're right. And then the distant aftermath where Aunt Haiti moved on to have a beautiful, sunny disposition and a great life. So yeah.
Thanks for chatting and letting me read those.
My name is Judy Spitznagel, aka Judy Lowen. Aunt Helen was one of my dear, dear aunts. She was a big part of my life. Well, they were so supportive of mom, both your mom and dad, when dad died, right? Your dad kind of stepped up and became a surrogate dad to Vic. And your dad would include me in all of the, you know, we go hiking around the riverbank on Saturdays and so on. So that I think mom would have a little bit of a break and we would have a father in a way. So your family was very close to ours. Like always going over there and just loving it. And the cousins would all hang out together. And she would always make these juices that were a mixture of some kind of, you know, it wasn't orange juice or apple juice. It had, you know, a little bit of crab apple juice in there and some 7-Up or ginger ale. And, you know, there was always something special to drink at their house. And I always envied my cousins' braids because your mom would braid their hair so beautifully. And I would cry because my hair is short and it couldn't be braided. One quick note, she always made me feel treasured and loved. I was adopted and she always made sure that she just accepted me as one of the family. She wrote lovely letters to us and often had little stickers all over the letters, a little animal sticker or a bird sticker or whatever. She'd go back to my dad and how my dad was and his kind and his nature. She was supportive of me and my kind of emotional, sensitive nature. She says, oh, this is from September 15th, 2014. Never feel badly for the emotional part of you. That is a very dear part of who you are and of how God made you. And that has stayed with me forever because it just meant so much. All right. And now I have a bit longer one from November 3rd, 2010. Dear Judy and Bob, thank you so much for your recent letter. I love the Halloween decorations on each page. They're so bright and cheerful and make me smile. I've never liked the ghoulish, evil tombstone side of Halloween. I do like the little kids trick-or-treating, all excited, dressed in their costumes. They're so sweet. The cutest costume I saw this year was a little girl dressed as a ladybug. It was a very nicely made costume with nice detail, perhaps purchased. However, it wasn't flimsy like some of the store-bought costumes. It made me think of something that Grandma Thiessen could have made. Do you remember that clown or jester costume she made? It was red and yellow in color. She made the collar and cap to match. Each point in the collar had a little bell attached, as did the cap. It was made for you or Vic, if I remember correctly, then passed down through the family for years. We have one Halloween slide of David, Kathy, and Lynn, in which Kathy is wearing that costume. David is a spaceman, and Lynn is a witch wearing the costume that I made. Grandma Thiessen was the most wonderful seamstress. And then your mom drew a picture. Can you see it there?
I can, yeah,
of that. So, I mean, her memory is so unbelievable. And I know I wore that costume forever because a snowsuit would fit underneath it.
Right, yeah. She just marveled at things that were innocent, but also beautiful.
Well, all of that too. And then all of that that she comments about brings her back to the past and another memory from the past. And so much of it has to do with family.
Right.
And that's what I guess I really cherished, because who knows you better than these people who've been around since I was a little kid.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Well, it's sure nice of you to do this.
Nice of you to include me. My gosh, it's an honor.
Oh, great.
So with that, we'll conclude part two, the stories of Helen as a young adult. In part three, we'll share what Helen wrote about being a wife and mother with five kids around a busy household, with all the goings-on and responsibilities and shenanigans that she experienced through that part of her life. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for part 3.